tensions flare up again in the Al-Aqsa Mosque after Israeli forces raid Muslims' third holiest site. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas describes the raid as a serious escalation. Moscow says the United States' move to provide intelligence to the Ukrainian military will not hinder Russia's military campaign. Voters across the UK head to the polls to elect their new local representatives, with a recent survey predicting huge losses for the Conservative Party. Hello and welcome, everybody. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque to make way for settlers to enter the holy site in occupied Al-Quds City. A number of Palestinians were injured as Israeli forces fired rubber bullets and tear gas. Israeli troops have on various occasions attacked Palestinians at Al-Aqsa over the past several weeks. And that comes despite repeated warnings by Palestinians urging the regime to stop desecrating the holy site. Resistance movement Hamas has reacted to the latest Israeli attack, calling it a serious escalation and direct provocation. Islamic Jihad also said all those gathering at Al-Aqsa to defend it are supported by resistance groups. The Fatah party reacted as well. It promised a firm response to occupiers and called on all Palestinians to converge on Al-Aqsa. Earlier, we were joined by our Gaza-based correspondent, Asher Shannon. He says the international community is holding the conflict in Ukraine in the spotlight while turning a blind eye to the Palestinian struggle.
So for decades, the international community has turned a blind eye to the Palestinian struggle for freedom. We've seen the recent situation with Russia and Ukraine and how the world, especially Western countries, have shown double standards regarding the situation in Ukraine and the situation in Palestine. And Palestinians are also blaming the recent escalations on Arab countries, especially in the Persian Gulf region, who normalize their ties with the Israeli regime. They believe that such actions have given Israel a green light to do as it wish as it wishes regarding the violation of the Palestinians and the violation of their rights.
Well, historian and journalist Brecht Yonker says some Muslim countries have unfortunately been enticed by Israeli money in recent years and ignored the Palestinian cause.
More and more Arab League countries, and specifically, and unfortunately Muslim countries in general, there are more and more of these regimes, of these governments that have been enticed by the prospect of basically Zionist funds, Zionist money, and the direct material and financial benefits of doing business with the Zionist entity and of recognizing the Zionist entity, and have de facto been bribed out of supporting the Palestinian cause. Now, honesty requires us to admit that a lot of these countries have only been really supporting Palestine in words and not in deeds for already a long time. Specifically, of course, some of the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Bahrain, even if they, until a few years ago, were to support Palestine by word of mouth, they never really did anything to support them. But now we see that since 2020, specifically, some of these countries, some of these governments have openly gone over to the other side and have started blatantly collaborating with the Zionist entity. And that's specifically the case in the UAE and in Bahrain and in countries like Morocco as well. And this is a very, very deplorable situation, because indeed these people, these leaders, these rulers still claim to be self-professed Muslims. And as such, when an attack is taking place against the sanctuary, against the Al-Aqsa compound, this is an attack against all of Islam and an attack against all Muslims worldwide.
The controversial and Israeli-made Pegasus spyware has appeared again, this time in Spain. Many high-ranking Spanish officials have fallen victim to the application, a reminder that it's breaching privacy. Its sole purpose is to spy, and it is undemocratic. But then again, that could be the appeal it has for those purchasing and using it.
outrage is rising in Spain over a hacking scandal. It has now emerged that more than 200 mobile phone numbers in the country have been hacked. The cell phones of the Spanish Prime Minister and Defence Minister were amongst the targeted numbers. Authorities have detected the Pegasus spyware in the mobile phones of Pedro Sanchez and Margarita Robles. Prime Minister Sanchez's mobile phone was breached twice in May 2021 and Defence Minister Robles's device was targeted once the following month. All in all, 2.6 gigabytes of information was obtained from the Spanish Prime Minister's phone during the first attack and 130 megabytes during the second, while 9 gigabytes were stolen from the Defence Minister. Spain's highest criminal court opened a probe into how the mobile phones of Sanchez and Robles were infected. Madrid has described the hacking as, quote, illicit and external attacks.
The illegal tampering of these phones has been proven in an ongoing verification that will reach all members of the government. We are reporting facts that are verified and reliable, not assumptions. These are extremely serious facts that confirm that intrusions have taken place in areas outside a state institution and outside the law.
The mobile number selections, believed to have been made by Morocco, occurred in 2019. Spain's socialist-led government is also under pressure to explain why devices belonging to dozens of people connected to the separatist movement in the northeastern Catalonia region were infected with Pegasus. The regional Catalan government has accused authorities in Madrid of spying on separatists.
So the Israeli Mossad has had a constant intelligence gathering operation against any client that is foolish enough to buy their materials. And this is being confirmed in the Spanish Prime Minister situation. So the CIA, the MI6, and the Mossad have always entertained a mutual intelligence sharing operation. And this revelation of the Spanish Prime Minister is just another example of that.
Well, the reason or reasons this software is controversial are many. You may recall the software was used to carry out surveillance on journalists, activists, and even kings, presidents, and political leaders. This use was especially criticized in the case of regimes who utilize it to control and jail their opponents, and none is more controversial than its use by Saudi Arabia and its crown prince, given what happened to Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Pegasus is a malware developed by the Israeli technology and cyber arms company NSO Group. Unlike most spyware, Pegasus doesn't require its victims to unwittingly download it. Once installed, it allows NSO's clients to take control of a device to activate the camera and the microphone, see geolocation data, and read the content of messages. The company claims the spyware is used for counterterrorism purposes, but it's been accused of helping facilitate authoritarianism.
Well, the Israelis are notorious for the development of technology that they can sell to dictatorial regimes like Saudi Arabia, like United States, like the United Kingdom, as well as others. But they always install a backdoor as well.
There are now serious concerns within the European Union about the spyware. In 2020, a target list of 50,000 phone numbers leaked out and analysed by international media and rights groups revealed that the list contained the numbers of leading opposition politicians, human rights activists, journalists, lawyers and other politicians. In France, President Emmanuel Macron is believed to have been on a list of potential Pegasus targets. And UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been warned that his office may have been targeted in 2020 and 2021. It's now emerged that the phone of Jamal Khashoggi's wife was also infected with the spyware. Khashoggi was a dissident Saudi journalist who was brutally murdered in Istanbul in 2018. The European Data Protection Supervisor, the European Authority on Data Protection, is already advocating for prohibiting the development and deployment of espionage programs with capabilities such as Pegasus.
I think what we're going to see is the revelation that the Israelis are spying on everyone with the blessing of the United States, and you're going to see a departure from their technology and countries seeking more solid, safe communication channels, such as that which is being offered by Russia, China, and India.
NSO Group has already been placed on the U.S. blacklist. The decision reflects deep concern about the impact of spyware on U.S. national security interests.
Moscow slams the West for providing weapons to Ukraine, saying such moves prolong Russia's military campaign in the country.
Coupled with the flow of weapons that these countries are sending to Ukraine, these are all actions that do not contribute to the quick completion of the operation, but at the same time, they are not capable of hindering the achievement of the goals set.
Peskov said Russia was well aware that the United States and its allies are also regularly feeding intelligence to the Ukrainian military. He was reacting to a New York Times report that claimed the U.S. has assisted Kiev's forces in killing Russian generals by sharing intelligence on their location inside Ukraine. The report does not specify how many generals were killed with American help. However, a spokeswoman for the U.S. National Security Council rejected the Times article. Adrian Watson insisted that American battlefield intelligence was not provided to the Ukrainian forces with the intent to kill Russian generals. A three-day ceasefire in the Russian-held city of Mariupol, southern Ukraine, has come into effect. The truce began at 500 GMT on Thursday. It was announced by Russia a day earlier. A humanitarian corridor has also opened to evacuate civilians from the site of the Azovstal steel plant. Moscow says civilians sheltering there are allowed to travel to Russia or Ukraine-controlled territory. The plant is the last stronghold of Ukrainian forces in the port city of Mariupol. Russia took control of the city last month. Lawmakers warn of dire social consequences for EU citizens after the European Commission proposes to ban Russian oil imports. The 27-nation EU is already enduring record-high inflation and energy prices. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Hundreds of civil servants inside the European Commission are working on a sixth round of sanctions against Moscow over the conflict in Ukraine. More Russian individuals, banks and media outlets are being targeted. There is also a proposal to completely stop the importation of Russian oil into the 27-country EU. Legislators say the measures will not only hurt Russia.
They will also affect the lives of European citizens with a direct impact on their homes, their jobs, their wallets.
A debate on Wednesday in the European Parliament heard that inflation in the EU is eating up wages and pensions. Apparently, 36 million people in the bloc are unable to sufficiently heat their homes.
We should not talk about energy poverty anymore. We are talking about actual poverty. People who cannot pay their bills anymore. And therefore, my proposal is to organise a social summit.
The new social crisis and Ukrainian refugee crisis are placing additional pressures on EU health systems, including mental health services. Those working in the sector say there is not enough financial support from governments.
I have a lot of colleagues, they are leaving, they don't want to work as a nurse anymore because the pressure is too high. And because if you have a lot of people inside the houses that cannot pay the rent, they cannot afford to pay food, they cannot pay the gas and electricity, of course they are going to have mental issues.
Pope Francis says NATO's, quote, barking at Russia's door may have caused the conflict in Ukraine. Some EU lawmakers agree and suggest Washington is mostly to blame.
The US needs the war to reinforce the unipolar power, while Ukraine, the people of Europe, and hundreds of millions in the global south will pay the price.
The European Commission's latest sanctions on Russia are presently just proposals.
Ban all Russian oil.
Hungary and Slovakia look set to veto the oil ban. There is growing concern surrounding how the Kremlin might respond to such a ban.
That's because Russia's gas is even more important to the EU's economy than its oil. Economists say if Moscow was to switch off the gas immediately, it would be game over for the European Union. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The family of Iranian citizen Hamid Nouri, currently facing trial in Sweden, has faced daily abuse and harassment from supporters of an anti-Iran terrorist group while attending court sessions in Sweden. Nouri is accused of human rights abuses. His family denies all allegations and says he's been mistreated in custody in Sweden. Robert Carter reports.
The family of an Iranian citizen on trial in Sweden has released shocking allegations of mistreatment as they continue to fight a lengthy legal battle for his release. Hamid Nouri was arrested at Stockholm Airport in 2019. Charges brought against him include human rights abuses against prisoners dating back to 1988. Nouri's wife told Press TV that he'd been held in solitary confinement, physically assaulted by prison staff, and subjected to mental torture. Nouri and his family deny all allegations. His detention has been branded illegal by Tehran.
Not only has the trial been condemned by Iranian authorities as unlawful, but also the treatment of the family of the accused. Shocking footage of Nouri's family being harassed has deepened Iranian anger at the Swedish authorities for their poor handling of the case.
Nouri's family have been in and out of court all week. Every time they arrive, supporters of a notorious anti-Iran terror group, MKO, harass and threaten them. The Swedish authorities are slow to respond. Away from the protesters, we spoke to a local Iranian eyewitness who saw this disgraceful behaviour.
It was just really, really sad for me to see an old woman walking up to the stairs to the court and hearing a bunch of words, which actually I'm ashamed even to think about it, not even bring it to my mouth, to even think about it. But this group are known, as I said. We know those people exactly how they are. We know those people from the time which they was killing Iranian soldiers during the war with Iraq. We know those people when they was, I would love to say, leaking Saudi regime's shoes for getting a bunch of dollar or money or whatever, or support from a terrorist regime, as American regime. I really would like to know what's going on for about Sweden, actually. Sweden, a country which always talk about human rights and freedom and democracy, now are supporting and making a favor and show for a group which they have been in years in a terrorist list for whole world, international terrorist list.
The accusations against Nouri are mostly taken from members of this same group. The MKO has been accused of fabricating atrocities multiple times, again raising questions about the credibility of the prosecution, who wished to see Nouri sentenced to life. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. The day when the war broke out, I am speaking about the sacred defense era, many of us would think that the war would last a week, 10 or 20 days, but it lasted 8 years. From the first day, Imam Rahmatullah Alayhi was confident. Well, some people used to say on that day why such and such decisions was not taken. Well, they were not present and they did not know about the various aspects of the issue. It is possible that some mistakes were done in certain cases at that time. I mean, in general, I do not want to get involved in details, But the general movement was a movement of patience and piety, and eventually things thankfully ended in our victory. The same is true of various other matters. With all these successful experiences that we had in different areas, it would be really an act of oppression to the people, the country, and the revolution if someone decided today to make the people disappointed, to inject a feeling of impasse in the people, and to demolish the people's morale and undermine officials' determination. Of course, our indicators in certain areas are negative.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the economic area, the indicators are not good. All of us agree on this. Previous and future officials and managers and everyone else know that the indicators are not satisfactory in various years until today. Of course, all these are improvable. All these economic problems are definitely correctable by God's favor, and they will be corrected. But the economy is not the only criterion of power, progress, and success. There are other criteria as well. Those criteria must be seen as well. Even in the area of the economy, there are signs of success in different areas, some of which I will mention. First of all, despite the sanctions against our country, the sanctions that existed before and that exist today are unprecedented sanctions. They themselves have acknowledged that from the beginning of history, no country has experienced such sanctions. Our economy did not fail. Despite the predictions made by foreigners saying that Iran would become bankrupt, this did not happen, and the economy remained up and running.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Pentagon says it's training Ukrainian troops in Germany and other locations in Europe, an announcement that's likely to anger Russia. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said Germany is one of the roughly three locations where over 100 Ukrainian troops are being trained on operating howitzer artillery systems and radars. The troops are set to go back to Ukraine and provide a training to others on how to operate the systems that the United States has recently pledged to the country. Kirby also says the United States is considering training Ukrainian troops on how to use other equipment in a virtual format. The White House has recently called on Congress to provide $33 billion in additional assistance to Ukraine, some two-thirds of which earmarked for military purposes. Washington has already sent millions of dollars worth of weapons and equipment to Ukraine. That's on top of the aid packages other NATO allies have allocated to Kiev.
A war between these two great superpowers, the U.S. and Russia, would be absolutely disastrous for the entire world with the threat of nuclear war. But in practicality, absolutely, it does mean that. It does mean that just as we have in Syria, where the U.S. will train extremist fighters, the U.S. is functionally at war with the Syrian government and the Syrian people, though perhaps not literally on paper. I think the same thing applies to Ukraine. If the U.S. is going to fund and now actively train people to fight against Russia's special operation in Ukraine, then the U.S. is functionally at war.
Russia has earlier warned that weapons poured into Ukraine from the West will be fair game for its strikes. The United States and other NATO member states had initially said they didn't want to enter into a direct conflict with Russia. Is that the reason why they're helping prolong the war in Ukraine, which in effect is likely to turn into a proxy conflict? On May 1st, Adam Kinzinger, a Republican congressman representing Illinois' 16th congressional district, introduced a resolution dubbed Authorization for Use of Military Force to Defend America's Allies, or AUMF. If passed, the resolution would enable U.S. President Joe Biden to use his war powers against Russia in case Moscow carries out a chemical or nuclear strike in Ukraine. But in the event of a war, the concept of mutually assured destruction will be on the table, meaning that the two sides, both nuclear powers, will be risking total annihilation. That could explain why both have ruled out the possibility of a direct confrontation. It can also be the reason why the West has resorted to imposing sanctions on Russia and providing Ukraine with assistance. One such example is the spy satellites belonging to the U.S. military and private firms that are gathering intel on Russian military positions and movements in Ukraine and relaying them to the U.S. and its allies, including Kiev itself.
I mean, if there's anything that we learned from the 90s, it's that when NATO gets involved in a war, it is disastrous for the civilians more than anyone else. We saw that in Yugoslavia. And unfortunately, it looks like we may see that again in Ukraine. And if NATO were to become involved, if NATO were to declare war on Russia or even amp up its support for Ukraine, be it money, weaponry, training, whatever it may be, it will be disastrous. And it will make this conflict become more prolonged, which is, I'm sure, what Lockheed Martin and Boeing and the other big corporations in the U.S. military-industrial complex want.
These developments are pushing the tensions to the point of no return. What's certain is that a possible war between superpowers won't have a winning side.
Leading a congressional delegation, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has paid a visit to Ukraine. Pelosi, who is the highest-ranking American leader to visit Ukraine since the start of the war, has reiterated Washington's support for Ukraine. During a meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, she vowed that the U.S. would stand by Ukraine until the end of the war with Russia.
We believe that we are visiting you to say thank you for your fight for freedom, that we are on a frontier of freedom, and that your fight is a fight for everyone. And so our commitment is to be there for you until the fight is done.
The United States is in an explicit war to weaken Russia and to defeat Russia, to help Ukrainian government defeat Russia in Ukraine. And it's You know, Zelensky is really is someone who isn't making the decisions here. He's not going to be allowed to make a deal unless the United States lets him and unless the right-wing forces in Ukraine let him.
Zelensky, for his part, thanked the U.S. and its Congress for, in his own words, the powerful signal of support. Pelosi's visit comes as the U.S. and its allies are stepping up to provide long-term support to Ukraine as the fighting rages on. Later in a statement, Pelosi said Russian President Vladimir Putin's, quote, diabolic invasion had taken a devastating human toll on Ukrainians. She also pledged imminent additional American support for Ukraine. The U.S. has already committed $4.3 billion to Kyiv in military support since 2021. Now, in a major increase of such funding, U.S. President Joe Biden has called on Congress to provide another $33 billion in emergency funding for Ukraine, including $20 billion for military aid. Moscow has warned that the aid would only fuel the conflict. Also, last week, responding to pleas from Zelensky, a group of 40 nations gathered by the U.S. and Germany agreed to streamline and expedite the delivery of weapons to Ukraine. Western nations have imposed broad economic sanctions on Russia and have been shipping increasing quantities of weapons to confront Russian forces. The Western intervention could lead to Russia's military response and raise the risk of confrontation between Russia and NATO, as well as a nuclear conflict. Some experts believe Washington's war aims had broadened from helping Ukraine to defend itself to damaging Russia itself. This notion supports the Russian narrative that Moscow's actions in Ukraine are to defend itself against NATO. U.S. President Joe Biden has proposed a $33 billion package for arming and supporting Ukraine. He also outlined proposed new laws to transfer the frozen assets of Russia's elite to Ukraine. The proposal is part of U.S. policies to ratchet up economic pressure on Russia over the Ukraine war. On the other hand, Moscow has warned that it may seize the Russian-based assets of countries it considers hostile. The Speaker of Russia's lower house of parliament says the proceeds from the sale of these assets will be used for the country's development. Vyacheslav Volodin accused some countries of violating international law and resorting to pure theft. He particularly named Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, and even the United States. Volodin said the U.S. has set a dangerous precedent that could backfire. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry said on Sunday it had carried out a missile strike on a military airfield near the port city of Odessa, destroying a runway and a hangar containing weapons and ammunition supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. and European countries. That's after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned that any shipment of weapons by NATO into Ukraine would be a legitimate target for Russia. Lavrov had also blamed Ukraine for the current impasse in the peace talks, accusing Kyiv of a desire to play games. He said the negotiations could have produced results if it was not for the interference of the United States and Britain.
Are they willing to go all in a war against Russia here? They are going to have to put massive amounts of weaponry in. And the Russians are going to try to prevent that. So we are in a very dangerous place where there's a significant possibility of not only a regional but a world war.
Moscow has also blasted the West for encouraging Ukraine to strike Russia. That's after UK Defense Minister Ben Wallace said Ukraine has the right to strike military targets inside Russia. Meanwhile, the Russian President Vladimir Putin said earlier that any country deemed to be interfering in Ukraine would meet a lightning-fast response using weapons.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has once again stated that Pyongyang could preemptively use its nuclear weapons if threatened. In a meeting with the top military brass, Kim expressed a firm will to continue developing his nuclear-armed military so that it could preemptively and thoroughly contain and frustrate all dangerous attempts and threatening moves, including ever-escalating nuclear threats from hostile forces if necessary. His comments come as he praised his top military officials over the staging of a massive military parade in the capital Pyongyang last Monday. The parade marked the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Korean People's Revolutionary Army. It also featured the country's latest intercontinental ballistic missiles. On that occasion, too, Kim vowed to accelerate the development of North Korea's nuclear arsenal.
The basic mission of our nuclear force is to deter war, but our nuclear weapons cannot be bound to only one mission. If any force attempts to usurp the fundamental interests of our country, our nuclear force will have no choice but to carry out its second mission unexpectedly.
The country has progressed its nuclear and missile program despite international pressure over the past years. North Korea has conducted 13 rounds of weapons launches in 2022 alone, including its first full-range test of an intercontinental ballistic missile since 2017. In addition, satellite imagery has shown signs of activity at a nuclear testing site. Pyongyang has been reeling under crippling international sanctions over its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile development activities, which it maintains are designed to deter potential aggression by the US and its allies, including South Korea, who frequently hold joint military drills and weapon tests on the Korean Peninsula. Meanwhile, South Korea says Pyongyang's military tests escalate tensions and worsen ties between the two neighbors. But Pyongyang says its tests are in response to mounting tensions on the Korean Peninsula, triggered by joint military exercises between Seoul and Washington. The United States also stations about 28,500 troops in the south. The latest developments come as South Korea prepares for an incoming president, Yoon Suk-yeol, who takes a more hawkish approach to Pyongyang and has not ruled out a preemptive strike if necessary, vowing to strengthen the South's defense in conjunction with the alliance with the United States. Nuclear negotiations between Washington and Pyongyang have been stalled since 2019 because of disagreements over a potential easing of US-led sanctions in exchange for North Korean disarmament steps. Former US President Donald Trump met with the North's leader three times, but he refused to meet Pyongyang's demand for the removal of some sanctions in return for major North Korean measures toward demilitarization. Meanwhile, the current administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed sanctions on dozens of North Korean people and entities. Surely, that's not a sign of goodwill to resolve differences. There is also the issue of South Korea. The new president is pro-U.S., adding to the friction between the two Koreas. Meanwhile, Kim has stuck to his goal of simultaneously developing nuclear weapons and the country's dismal economy in the face of sanctions, and has shown no willingness to fully surrender a nuclear arsenal he sees as his biggest guarantee of survival.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea, also known as North Korea, has always, from day one of its founding as a sovereign nation and republic, a people's republic, has always developed its military capabilities in defense against U.S. imperialism, against European imperialism.
Pyongyang has time and again stressed that the primary role of possessing nukes was to discourage threats against the country. After all, it makes sense, particularly when we look at the example of Ukraine. Even the Ukrainian ambassador to Tehran confessed that his country should have developed its military capabilities instead of relying on guarantees from foreign forces such as NATO.
A recent report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States over the past year. In a news conference following the publication of the report, head of the council, Nihad Awad, described Islamophobia in the United States as deep and systematic.
Islamophobia has become mainstream in America. It made its way into the government, institutions, and public sphere through laws, policies, political rhetoric, and other manifestations.
Yeah, Islamophobia has been a huge phenomenon in the U.S. since 2001, when the September 11th false flag operation was deliberately used by enemies of Islam to trigger this tidal wave of hatred of Muslims and Islam that led to a series of wars that killed millions of people.
The report shows that the council received over 6,700 complaints nationwide last year, the highest the organization has recorded in 27 years, which represented a 9% increase since the year before. They involved a range of issues, including immigration, travel discrimination, law enforcement, government overreach, hate and bias, custody rights, school incidents, and free speech. Over 2,800 of the incidents were reportedly travel-related. The report cites last year's tensions in Afghanistan and the ensuing immigration crisis as the reason for such a large figure. The report also cites a 28% increase in complaints of hate and bias incidents, including the forcible removal of hijabs, harassment, vandalism, physical assault, and so on. The Council on the American-Islamic Relations describes what it calls the Islamophobia Network as a decentralized group of actors, organizations, and individuals that share extreme anti-Muslim ideologies who lobby to influence government policy and public opinion about Islam. They include politicians, think tanks, scholars, religious groups, and activists that paint a distorted face of Islam and Muslims for political and financial gain. Listed among the top financiers of the Islamophobia Network, according to the council, are right-wing evangelical groups and pro-Israel organizations, most of whom are members of the Republican Party.
Islamophobia has not only been profitable for Zionists and the military-industrial complex and politicians, but also for these con artists who've created an Islamophobia industry that sells all kinds of books and drums up contributions, often at churches, and gets funded by these billionaire, mostly Zionists.
Back in December, the U.S. House voted for legislation to counter Islamophobia globally. The lawmakers voted along party lines, with the Democrats edging only 7 votes over the 212 that the Republicans had cast. It followed U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert's Islamophobic comments against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, one of the handful Muslim lawmakers in the U.S., earlier that month.
The Islamophobia industry comes up with all sorts of nonsense and sort of distorted, cherry-picked items from the religious tradition mixed in with all sorts of lies and kinds of grotesque accusations. And then it spams this out in mass, and so it's really polluting the entire infosphere.
The United Nations has called for the adoption of a global strategy that includes defeating all forms of violent ideologies. The question is how to execute such a strategy to make it appealing to all nations and people.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you.
seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawa'ij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kazim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام ليس الحمية أن تدع الشيء أصلا لا تأكله، ولكن الحمية أن تأكل من الشيء وتخفف.
إمام موسى الكاظم عليه السلام stated, diet control is not to avoid eating absolutely anything. Rather, diet control is to eat lightly.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, in the beautiful conversations and dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam, we find that Imam al-Kazim talks to his companions about not regarding sins as small. It is a very interesting thing, but sometimes we think that a sin is small, it is insignificant, relative to perhaps other greater sins. Now the problem is that we tend to then think or imagine that this smaller sin is something that we don't need to consider or take into consideration, or it is something that we shouldn't worry about when it comes to the disobedience of Allah. But we find that in response to this comment of one of his companions, Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam says, do not regard as much a good deed, and do not regard as little few sins, for few sins come together and add up and become many. So fear Allah in private that you may become just. So dear friends, we find here first and foremost that when it comes to good deeds as well, sometimes we think that, well, I did such a great deed. I did such a big thing. When in reality, Imam Al-Qadhim here in this conversation and in this dialogue tells his companion, no, never consider your good deed to be a great thing. For one of the things that comes about with considering one's deeds to be great and awesome and mighty is that we go towards arrogance. And a second thing that might happen is the fact that we won't continue to do better things because we believe that what we have done is sufficient. And sins is the opposite. Never consider a sin to be small or insignificant, as Imam Al-Qadhim says, because many small sins come together and all of a sudden they become many. They become so many that we end up drowning in this ocean of small sins, which of course leads to our loss in both this world and the hereafter. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Qadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kazim, alayhi salam.
You know, one of the names that we call him is Kazim, which means that comes from Kazm. He would refrain from getting disappointed or upset or angry. He would control his anger. Wa Kazimin al-Ghayth. وَالْعَافِينَ عَلِ النَّاسِ, as the Quran says, that he would control the anger and he will afi, he will forgive the people, always forgiving. And it really reflects that how mazloom the Imam was. Majority of the time of his life he left in very dead and dreadful and dark prisons. History is self-evidence, where we, when we visit Baghdad, those who have the opportunity to visit Baghdad and those who have visited these prisons, you could find that these prisons, when a person enters to these historical sites of the prisons of the Imam, one is unable to even stand up properly. One is unable to really stand up properly. You know, that's how Imam was praying there, in those sort of very thin, low roof prisons. Imagine how he might have been breathing there.
For listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en. Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
the 1990s, a big crime was committed in Southeast Europe, which reminded the world of the Middle Ages. The Bosniaks were killed by other groups in former Yugoslavia because they said no to the formation of Serbia and its independence, and more importantly, because they were Muslims. Genocide was committed against Bosniaks in order to cleanse the Green Continent of Muslims and consign Islam into oblivion forever. But a different fate awaited the Bosniaks. Prior to the arrival of Islam in Bosnia, the Bogomils were united Christians and were resisting the preachers of the Roman Church. In the 11th century, merchants from Khorasan entered this region for business. Their behavior, which was based on their Islamic thought, led to the introduction of Islam in this region, where people accepted the religion and embraced it. This is Sarajevo, the capital city of Bosnia and Herzegovina that shares borders with Serbia and Croatia. Bosnia and Herzegovina is a country which has survived hundreds of years of genocide and has managed to keep Islam alive by itself in Europe. One of the existing Islamic symbols in Sarajevo is a water-drinking place called Sakohone, which is located in an old neighborhood of the city. It is said that a total of 72 such places had been built in Sarajevo in memory of the 72 companions of the third Shia Imam, Imam Hussein, who were martyred during the Battle of Karbala. Currently, one of those places has turned into a cultural symbol of Bosnia and Herzegovina and its capital city. Sarajevo also has a library which is regarded as a hub of history books on the Balkan Peninsula. The Gazi Husrev Beg Library, dating back to 500 years ago, has more than 10,000 books and collections of manuscripts in Arabic, Ottoman, and Persian. At midday in the summer, Franz Ferdinand, the heir to the throne of Austro-Hungary, and his wife were shot and killed by a young Serbian man in Sarajevo. The murder ignited the First World War that led to an end to Ottoman rule on Bosnia and put it under Austro-Hungary control. Following the Second World War, the competition between communism and liberalism resulted in the formation of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia by the Balkan countries, and that marked the beginning of a new era for Muslims in this region. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia witnessed changes as well, and various regions there declared independence. Slavs in Slovenia, Croats in Croatia, and Muslims in Bosnia and Herzegovina. But the formation of a Muslim-majority country that opposed the establishment of a Serbian government was not to the liking of European leaders. A day after a referendum on independence, a plot was hatched that caused the genocide of Muslims in this region.